And Jeremy Rose is here. Hello.
G'day.
This is the Midweek Media Watch. A member of the Media Watch team turns their eye to what's going on in the media. And perhaps we should begin briefly with a quick chat about this week's local democracy announcement.
Yeah, so on Monday it was announced. It's kind of been in the wind for a little while. We actually mentioned it in a program back in December that Radio New Zealand and the newspapers were talking about replicating a BBC project. And basically it's as a result of this massive decline in the reportage of local body democracy. We've done a background on it on the Media Watch page so people can go and read and catch up with what's happening, and we'll be going into more detail on Sunday. There'll be an item. Last year when I did that report, I reported on the Hutt Valley and how they were debating whether to change the electoral system, and nobody reported it. Now I've got the chance to say, well, actually somebody did. It was the Eastbourne Herald, this little micro paper. But the Fairfax papers didn't mention it at all. So there really is a crisis there. This is a public subsidy to try and get reporting around the country, eight reporters. In that same program, I actually looked at the other end of the democratic spectrum, the United Nations, because I'd noticed that New Zealand was one of seven countries to vote against the Declaration of Peasant Rights. And I thought, God, what is this? And I did a little story. I thought it was fascinating. Sent off some OIAs to the MFAT afterwards. Pages and pages of redacted material I've received since, and some interesting stuff, including a comment that it made perfect sense from a Marxist revolutionary point of view, seizing the means of production, all that sort of thing. Well, then all redacted after that. But anyway, this week, another General Assembly vote caught my attention. It got quite a lot of coverage overseas. In fact, The Guardian headlined it, saying it was a massive defeat for Britain and the United Kingdom and the United States. And this is the vote on the Chagos Islands and whether the sovereignty should return to Mauritius. This is a little group of islands in the Indian Ocean. Have been under British control actually since Napoleonic times, but when Mauritius became independent, should have become gone with them. So it's been a long, ongoing debate. And here's what a woman from Mauritius told Al Jazeera when she described how she felt about it.
Physically and psychologically, it is torture. It is revolting and humiliating to know that we are being made beggars of what legitimately belonged to us. We are being taken advantage of just because we are small, black community.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, that gives you a sense of the passion there. And I just became kind of fascinated. I'd heard of the story, but I wanted to know more. And so I'm going to see whether our audience is kind of as interested in some of these international events as I am, and think that the way New Zealand voted is interesting or not. So let's hear now from an academic, Con Halliman, who explained why the British were so keen to hold on to these islands.
They would sing their way through life. Here, I mean, they wept their way through life, and they're still weeping, you see. And there were, as you mentioned, so many cases of suicides.
Sorry, that wasn't the one I was expecting. That was actually the president, former president of Mauritius, whose name I've just, Kassam Youtim. And he, now I'm worried I've got some of the numbers wrong. Actually, number three, so that was number three is the British academic. So if we listen to that
mix
now.
Up there, there we go.
The importance of Diego Garcia is its location in the Indian Ocean. It's able to dominate the east coast of Africa, the west coast of Pakistan and India, as well as the third largest body of water on the planet. It also is able to control access and entrance to the Persian Gulf and to the Red Sea. It played an enormously important role in the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and it currently plays an important role in the war in Syria and Somalia. And if there is some kind of confrontation between the United States and Iran, Diego Garcia, with its deep harbors and its large airfields, will be ground zero for any kind of military confrontation with Iran.
Oh, okay, so it's strategy.
It's incredibly important strategically, that's right. And I have to apologize to our listeners because I'm slightly confused now about where we are on these clips I've got, but let's play the next one and I'll explain it as we hear it out.
I must remind you that this has been done in violation of the United Nations Charter. This is why it was done so in absolute discretion and using lies. I'm not minting my words. They were lies, damn lies.
And so that again was Qassam Yuttim, the former president, and explaining that right from the beginning this was a breach of international law. And now we can hear from John Pilger, who made a documentary on this back in 2004, talking a bit about those lies.
What the official documents show is not just a trail of lies, but an imperious attitude of brutality and contempt. In August of 1966, Sir Paul Gore Booth wrote,
"We must surely be very tough about this. The object of the exercise was to get some rocks which will remain ours. There will be no indigenous population except seagulls."
At the end of this is a note handwritten by Dennis Greenhill, later Baron Greenhill of Harrow.
"Unfortunately, along with the birds go some few Tarzans or Men Fridays."
There's a kind of callousness there, you know. I mean, admittedly written in a note to, in the British office, they didn't expect people to, and the Foreign Office didn't expect people to read it, but it gives you a feel for that kind of imperial power. And there's another, here's a clip from James Schlesinger, who was the Secretary of Defense for the Americans, being questioned by Pilger.
"If you take a decision in Washington and London and it devastates the life of several thousand people on the other side of the world, isn't that something that should be called to account, no matter how long?"
"Amongst the various activities of the British and the American government in the 20th century, not to mention the 19th century, this was a relatively small matter. If one goes back to behavior, for example, in World War
II. Was the former Secretary of Defense, sorry, it was cut short. I've made a bit of a mess of some of these cuts.
We've all been there.
He went on to compare it to the saying, look, this is nothing in, compared to the bombing of Dresden or these things. We've committed far worse crimes in
it's
the
all
past.
Relative.
It's all relative. And the, you know, it is, it's that kind of indifference that got me. And in one of the clips, there's an American explaining that we should really be grateful because they've done such an extraordinary effort to protect the endangered turtles. And it seemed, you know, just so out of context, I thought, you know, he must know there's these thousands of people who literally they talk about dying of sorrow, and there's, you know, and it's in Mauritius in the slums. And so he talked about these turtles, but then I noticed a WikiLeaks tweet where they retweeted one of their leaked documents where the British were saying to the Americans, look, if we declare a marine reserve around the whole of these islands, that will prevent these people from ever returning. Mm-hmm. There's just no chance of it. Another tweet I saw which caught my attention was from a former ambassador, Craig Murray, former British ambassador turned human rights campaigner. And he wrote, ahead of tomorrow's UN General Assembly on the Chagos Islands, UK embassies worldwide furiously lobbying that the base is essential to worldwide anti-terrorist operations. One bemused British ambassador just told me, we're basically saying we need this colony to torture people. So how did New Zealand vote on this issue? they abstained, one of 56 nations to abstain. And here's our ambassador, Craig Hawke, speaking at the United Nations.
New Zealand is a strong supporter of the international rules-based system. International obligations relating to processes of decolonisation have particular resonance for us, given our own history in the South Pacific.
Yeah, so we did abstain as the air. He went on to explain the reason we were abstaining was because we think they need more time. We, as a nation, did vote against it going to the International Court of Justice originally. Vanuatu is a country which supported it and even sent a delegation to present at the International Court of Justice hearings. At the time, they welcomed the fact that this had that the International Court of Justice had found that the Chagos Islands should go back to Mauritius, and hoped that it would have an impact on the West Papua issue and also on an issue which I'd never heard of, which was their dispute with France over the Matthew and Hunter Islands. So this is a little colonial dispute in our own region, which has had very little publicity. They're not inhabited, but they are of interest to both New Caledonia and Vanuatu. So, yeah, I don't think I've probably done as good a job as I could have of showing just how interesting this issue is. And I think New Zealanders would feel, you know, some might think, no, we've got to support the British and Americans and their campaign for the free world, and they need these bases for going to Afghanistan and Iraq because that's where the bombers can get to. If there's a war in Iran, the planes will be taking off from. But I think there'll be others who say this is just outrageous. I think this type of stuff could usefully be reported on. But as I said, very, very few reports. There was a Radio New Zealand news report which mentioned it, but I couldn't find anything on our website.
And speaking of media outlets not covering stories.
Yeah, there's this curious story that appeared on the Daily Blog, which is a left-wing blog run by Martin Bomber Bradbury. And it's a claim by Ross Morant, former MP, former police inspector, head of the Red Squad, and a honorary consul from Morocco, that he believes it's highly likely that his car, BMW, was broken into by people operating on behalf of the police. Now, the reason he says this is that somebody, in his words, from within the police tent, has told him that he should be careful and suggested that this had happened. Now, he thinks that it probably happened as a way of trying to warn him off from speaking to the Headhunters gang. So let's listen to... He did go ahead and speak to the Headhunters gang, and we can listen to a clip from the talk he gave now.
Beating up wives is not confined to the mongrel mob or the black power. It is in lovely, leafy Remuera. I recall as a detective locking up a guy, a QC, for assaulting his wife. I was ordered to release him because he was a QC.
And he went on to talk to these gang members about how he thinks the police can be trigger-happy.
Just look at that Puhoi thing a couple of days ago. We read, guy with a machete chases these guys, these two cops. Then we read, boom, 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 boom. They're both six shots each. All the bullets are gone. Cops have been chasing them all over town. The adrenaline's pumping, whippy. The guy gets out of the car. They fire the bullets. They hit him four times, once in the back. To me, that suggests that somebody with a machete.
You can see why, you know, he might think that the police would be unhappy with that kind of talk. It seems, you would hope, a huge stretch of the imagination to believe that the police would be so upset by those types of talks that they'd be breaking into a honorary consul's car.
Anybody's car.
Anybody's car, that's right.
Consul, yeah.
But it does seem to me that when a person has that pedigree, you know, they're a former MP, former police inspector, and they're making these types of claims, that you would expect it to be followed up. I spoke to Ross Morant today and he confirmed that the report was accurate. He said he had written to the Commissioner of Police CC'd in Andrew Little and Winston Peters, and that's last June, and he hasn't heard back. So I'm surprised it hasn't been followed up, the story, and I'm curious to hear from those other parties. So we'll see what happens.
We will see what happens. And finally, RNZ has been reporting, among others, on Pharmac. What have you made of that?
Yeah, look, it's an incredibly complicated topic and I won't go into it in great detail. Guy on Espen has done a four-part investigation. Some pretty interesting things have come out of that. The Buyers Club was the first part. This is people getting together or going overseas to buy drugs which they're not entitled to or not funded by Pharmac. There was a case of a drug switch. This is when you go from a branded drug to a generic, and the switch was MedSafe actually advised against it. So that sets off alarm bells. But there was also, and there's been quite a lot of criticism, I think, of seeing it as a kind of attack on Pharmac and the Pharmac model. And I was certainly uneasy with parts of it, in that it seemed to me that what we're often talking about, we've got these incredibly difficult decisions, and they are often illustrated by one person's very, very tragic story, and then we're supposed to weigh this up. And the reality is, when you've got a finite budget, there are always going to be people who are on the wrong side of that divide. And so there was a particularly good blog, I thought, written by a guy called Dr. Matt Boyd, former medical doctor and also a doctor of philosophy, literally studied philosophy, turned health researcher. And he's written a blog titled Guy On, We're the Problem, Not Pharmac. And in that's what he argues. He says, look, the target shouldn't be Pharmac. They've done an unbelievable job in giving New Zealand the cheapest pharmaceuticals in the world. If you want more drugs to be available, the only solution is for there to be more funding. And so we need to tell the politicians, and we need to tell the politicians where that money can come from. Now, there's a link to this blog, because I doubt whether many people have seen it, on the Media Watch page. I've put up, there's links to all the stories that we've mentioned today, a rundown of what we're talking about. So if people want to, they can go and listen to those. We've got time for any more?
Yeah. Let's keep talking, because I was going to play some music, but this is actually probably more interesting than that.
Well, there's a story that caught my eye, which was that it was done by Media Matters, and it tracks the news. It was tracking news coverage, and it found that that ABC, the American ABC, not the Australian one, that their news program had dedicated more coverage to the birth of Archie, the royal baby, than it had done in the entire year of 2018 to climate change. And, you know, it's quite extraordinary. But depressingly, CBS and NBC also performed pretty badly. I mean, not over the whole year, but on the day the royal baby died, which was the same day, the royal baby died, that's a terrible thing,
was born. No panic, everybody.
The Climate Change Extinction Report came out. And so CBS dedicated 4 minutes 27 seconds to Archie and 1 minute 21 seconds to the royal baby, and NBC 6 minutes 15, zero to the climate change report, to the extension report. And if we've got time, I might just indulge you a little bit more, because yes, I'm after a favour. And so I just want you to listen to a tiny segment of a video that's been watched 120,000 times so far on YouTube. Sorry. No, it's not coming. I think it's not there. So this, what I was going to play you was a sound. It sounds like an aeroplane taking off. It's that awful, awful sound. And it is the sound of a Kirby vacuum cleaner. Now, if you don't know Kirby's, it's a kind of perennial story in our newspapers where somebody complains about having been ripped off for buying these incredibly expensive American vacuum cleaners. And very quickly, they've got a headlight, a gearbox. They cost about $3,500. And I want to hear from people, for a story I'm doing, I want to hear from people about the, particularly from former Kirby salespeople. They only sell door-to-door. It's a company, an American company. They look like a 1950s car. And they... owned by Warren Buffett, I think, actually, now, that company.
All right. How do people get in touch with you?
They can get in touch with me on jeremy.rose@rnz.co.nz.
All normal spelling, I hope.
All normal spelling.
There we go. jeremy.rose@rnz.co.nz.